Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in the next half hour, we're going to visit a number of topics pertinent to health or scientific matters that, in turn, in the context of the major focal point of this program, which is anti-fascism and the machinations of international fascism and corresponding and related elements of the U.S. and other countries' national security establishments. One of the major focal points of the program over the years has been eugenics, and one of the outgrowths of eugenics, which is the euthanasia program in Germany, the T4 program, which led ultimately to the Nazi extermination programs. Those programs were based on eugenics thinking and legislation, which was very, very prominent in the United States, and American eugenics thinking and legislation profoundly influenced the Nazi racial legislation, which led to those extermination programs. In a miscellaneous archive show entitled Euthanasia in Contemporary America and Nazi Germany, I discussed similarities between the Right to Die movement and the T4 program in Germany. I've discussed the Right to Die movement in a number of different half-hour segments, including a pair of half-hour segments entitled The Right to Die Movement, and a pair of interviews with Wesley J. Smith, the author of the vitally important recent book, Forced Exit. And we'll be talking with Mr. Smith again in the not-too-distant future. I mention this as I'm recording this on the evening of Sunday, March 7th of 1999, because this past week, the California State Assembly had a bill introduced on its floor to legalize physician-assisted suicide, i.e. euthanasia. The San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, March 2nd of 1999, had the following story by Robert B. Gunnison, G-U-N-N-I-S-O-N, of the Chronicle Sacramento Bureau. It's Dateline Sacramento and headlined, Right to Die Bill Introduced in Assembly, subtitled, Terminally Ill Could Request Suicide Drugs. Igniting a debate over the right to die, an East Bay legislator introduced a bill yesterday that would allow terminally ill Californians to take a prescription pill to end their lives. The measure by Assemblywoman, Dion Ariner, A-R-O-N-E-R, and I may be mispronouncing that, a Democrat of Berkeley, mirrors Oregon's physician-assisted suicide law enacted in 1997, which allows terminally ill patients to ask a doctor for lethal medications. And skipping down in this story, I would note that it was the Oregon euthanasia law and a recent study which misleadingly, as we shall see, indicated that that law has not resulted in abuses, which was the inspiration for Ms. Ariner's introduction of this law, of this bill, I should say, in the State Assembly. Skipping down, a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine last month reported that none of the 23 people in Oregon who received prescription for lethal medications did so for financial reasons. Most of the terminally ill were more concerned with loss of autonomy or bodily functions because of their illnesses, according to the study. Note that. Of the 23 Oregonians who asked for the prescriptions, 15 took the medication, 6 died from their original illness, and 2 were alive as of January 1, 1999, the journal reported. 18 of the participants had cancer. Their average age was 69. And with regard to the California bill, and again, please note that the rationalization for introducing this bill was the, quote, successful, unquote, bill that passed in Oregon, the first physician-assisted suicide bill, something, by the way, discussed at considerable length in the second of two interviews that I did with Wesley J. Smith, the aforementioned author of the vitally important recent book, Forced Exit. And speaking of Wesley J. Smith, and the book Forced Exit, subtitled The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder, published by Times Books and copyrighted 1997, an excellent book that I strongly recommend. Wesley Smith had an article that was carried in the an op-ed column, I should say, discussing the Oregon information or disinformation or misinformation. And again, it was the results of the Oregon law that provided the rationalization for Ms. Ariner's introduction of that bill. The following is from the Wall Street Journal of Thursday, February 25th of 1999. This is an op-ed column by Wesley J. Smith, the author of Forced Exit, entitled Dependency or Death? Oregonians Make a Chilling Choice. Assisted suicide in Oregon has operated in a shroud of secrecy since the procedure was legalized by a 1997 referendum. But a new study, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, purports to shed light on the law's actual workings. Advocates of assisted suicide claim the report proves all as well. But a close reading reveals that many of the worries of assisted suicide opponents are entirely justified. 15 people in Oregon, we are told, legally committed suicide with the assistance of their doctors in 1998. According to the report, not one of them was forced into the act by intractable pain or suffering. Rather, those who died had strong personal beliefs and individual autonomy and chose suicide based primarily on fears of future dependence. That isn't how assisted suicide was supposed to work. For many years, we have been told repeatedly by advocates that assisted suicide is to be a, quote, last resort, unquote, applied only when nothing else can be done to alleviate unrelenting and intolerable suffering. Yet pain wasn't a factor in a single one of the Oregon suicides. Thus, rather than being a limited procedure performed out of extreme medical urgency, legalization in Oregon has actually widened the category of conditions for which physician-hastened death is seen as legitimate. Disability rights advocates point out that allowing assisted suicide based upon fear of needing help going to the toilet, bathing, and performing other daily life activities will involve far more disabled and elderly people than terminally ill ones. I would point out that a legal ruling by Judge Stephen Reinhardt with regard to assisted suicide, as discussed in the second of two interviews with Wesley Smith, basically mirrors the attitude toward physician-assisted suicide or toward euthanasia that was discussed in a German text by Binding and Hoch, which profoundly influenced Adolf Hitler and the German T4 program. And again, those half-hour segments, the interviews with Wesley Smith, and the program about euthanasia in Nazi Germany and contemporary America, as well as a good discussion of the American eugenics influence on the Nazi racial laws, that contained in the Seeds of Nuremberg program, those are all available from Spitfire. Time permitting, I will give the address, etc., for Spitfire at the end of the program. Returning to this Wall Street Journal article by Wesley Smith, speaking of disability rights advocates, he writes, "They also note that dependency is an issue primarily for people who are not actually dependent, and that like other difficulties in life, dependency is a circumstance to which people adjust with time." By the way, a point that I neglected to bring up is that the elderly and disabled people were among the early targets of the Nazi euthanasia program. They are also under the acts with regard to physician-assisted suicide and the widening of the law, or what Wesley Smith has appropriately termed the slippery slope in his book. Beginning again with this I'm going to repeat the last couple of sentences. "Disability rights advocates point out that allowing assisted suicide based upon fear of needing help going to the toilet, bathing, and performing other daily life activities will involve far more disabled and elderly people than terminally ill ones. They also note that dependency is an issue primarily for people who are not actually dependent, and that like other difficulties in life, dependency is a circumstance to which people adjust with time. To accept the notion that worry about the potential need for living assistance as a legitimate reason for doctors to write lethal prescriptions is to put disabled and elderly people at lethal risk. The dehumanizing message is that society regards such lives as undignified and not worth living. That is why 9 national disability rights organizations have come out strongly against legalizing assisted suicide, and none support it. The study also reports that the people who committed assisted suicide had, quote, shorter, unquote, relationships with the doctors who prescribed that lethally than did a control group of patients who died naturally. The exact time difference is not given, but we do know from earlier media reports that it may be quite short. The first woman to commit assisted suicide in Oregon had a 2.5-week relationship with the doctor who wrote her lethal prescription. Her own doctor had refused to assist her suicide, as had a second doctor who diagnosed her with depression. I would add that many patients who express the desire to kill themselves are in fact suffering from depression, which is treatable, and yet many American physicians can neither diagnose nor adequately treat depression. They're not trained to do that in medical school. Continuing, of this woman who had a 2.5-week relationship with the physician who wrote her lethal prescription, so she went to an advocacy group which referred her to a doctor willing to do the deed. Hers was not a unique case. The report states that 6 of the 15 people sought lethal prescriptions from 2 or more doctors. Assisted suicide proponents told us this wouldn't happen either. They promised that assisted suicide would only occur after a deep exploration of values between patients and doctors who had long-term relationships. Thanks to the study, we now know that death decisions are being made by doctors the patients barely know. This isn't careful medical practice. It is rampant Kevorkianism. The study is as notable for what it omits as for what it includes. Information about the people who committed assisted suicide came from death prescription doctors. Treating doctors who did not participate in their patients' death professions, who could have provided invaluable information about the health of the people who died, were not interviewed. Nor were the doctors who refused to write lethal prescriptions. Family members were not contacted either. Significantly, the investigators made no attempt to learn whether the prescribing doctors were affiliated with assisted suicide advocacy groups, a matter of some importance if we are to know whether the decisions to prescribe lethally were based on medicine or ideology. Moreover, none of the patients were autopsied to determine whether they were actually terminally ill. I would note that in a recent case, a man killed his wife because she was diagnosed as having terminal cancer. An autopsy proved she didn't have cancer at all. Continuing. Near the end of the report, investigators admit they do not know whether any unreported existed suicides occurred. This is important. If history is any example, such deaths probably did happen. A recent Journal of Medical Ethics study about euthanasia in the Netherlands revealed that the Dutch policy is, quote, beyond effective control, unquote, since 59% of doctors do not report euthanasia or assisted suicide to authorities as requested by law. In Oregon, there is no punishment for failing to report an assisted suicide. Moreover, killing by doctors in the Netherlands has expanded far beyond the rare case originally contemplated when euthanasia was first permitted in that country more than 20 years ago. Patients who are not terminally ill are routinely assisted in suicide. Depressed people can also be killed upon request, even if they have no underlying organic disease. The lives of children born with birth defects are terminated by doctors based primarily on, quote, quality of life, unquote, considerations. Most chilling, in 1 out of 5 euthanasia cases, nearly 1,000 per year, the patient has not asked to be killed. The New England Journal of Medicine study is a warning that Oregon has started down the same destructive path. Rather than alleviating concerns, the study reveals that assisted suicide is bad medicine, and even worse, public policy. Well, that bad medicine and worse public policy may very well become law in the state of California in light of the fact that a bill was introduced this past week. And again, I'm recording this on the evening of March 7th, 1999, for the benefit of people who eventually hear this program on tape. A major focal point of numerous broadcasts, RFA 16, and numerous programs dealing with the virtual certainty at this point that AIDS was deliberately created, specifically a genetically engineered virus, which in all likelihood in combination with other microorganisms has led to the variety of diseases which has been subsumed under the title of AIDS. Again, that's discussed at great length in RFA 16 from April of 1986 and in numerous other broadcasts, including a 2-hour interview with the doctors Horowitz, Cantwell, and Garth Nicholson, and Ed Haslam, the author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. The interest on the part of the Pentagon and intelligence services in using microorganisms for the purposes of biological warfare and specifically for as weapons when combined with genetic engineering is a major focal point of those aforementioned programs and other half-hour segments available from Spitfire. In the context of the ongoing national security interest in the use of microorganisms as weapons of war, I find the following article very, very disturbing. I discussed the Pentagon research into the 1918 flu epidemic and attempts at recouping the virus responsible for that deadly epidemic in a pair of half-hour segments entitled Still More Fun with Science. Those are available from Spitfire. An update on that story is carried in the New York Times of Tuesday, February 16th of 1999. Again, the Times of 2/16/99 carries the following story by Gina Colata, K-O-L-A-T-A, entitled Scientists Uncover Clues to Flu Epidemic of 1918. Subtitled, But Why It Was So Deadly is Still a Mystery. Scientists report today that they have completed the first major step in deciphering the secrets of one of the deadliest viruses ever known, the influenza virus of 1918. Though their work answers some questions about the origin of the virus, the scientists say it leaves the most fundamental question dangling. What made the virus, which killed 20 million to 40 million people worldwide, so lethal? Dr. Jeffrey K. Taubenberger of the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology in Washington and his colleagues have determined the sequence of an essential gene, the hemagglutinin, finding that it is perfectly ordinary and dashing the hopes of those who had hoped it might hold the virus's deadly secrets. Skipping down, virologists are chilled by the statistics from the 1918 flu, which killed mostly people aged 20 to 40. If such a plague came today, killing a similar fraction of the United States population, 1.5 million Americans would die. It would kill more Americans in a single year than die annually from heart disease, cancers, strokes, chronic pulmonary diseases, AIDS, and Alzheimer's disease combined. And again, with the Pentagon doing this work, I think the possibility that that virus or some genetically altered version of same might be utilized as a weapon of war or perhaps of domestic use as well is something that cannot be dismissed. In particular, in the event of an economic collapse and the subsequent political crisis that would trigger not only around the world but especially in the United States, I think the temptation to utilize genetically engineered microorganisms to eliminate segments of the population might prove too great to resist. In particular, a half-hour segment updating research into genetic engineering vis-a-vis biological warfare, this recorded in early 1999, reported a Financial Times of London article from January 22nd of 1999 in which the British Medical Association warned that within 10 years, genetic engineering could be used to produce ethnic cleansing weapons which would take advantage of the minor genetic differences between various ethnic groups to produce ethnic cleansing weapons that would kill some people but not others based on, again, small genetic markers that exist between various ethnic groups. More on the subject of viruses, and in particular an apparently cancer-causing virus called the SV40 or simian virus 40. That virus figures prominently in the landmark research done by Ed Haslam, the author of Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus, and also by Dr. Leonard Horowitz in his vitally important recent book Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident, or Intentional. Those two gentlemen are participants in the aforementioned two-hour show along with Dr. Alan Cantwell and Dr. Garth Nicholson, who's done considerable research on an apparently genetically engineered mycoplasma with a gene from HIV apparently spliced into it that figures prominently in a large percentage of the cases of Gulf War syndrome. A recent report in the London Sunday Telegraph covered the discovery by Dr. Janet S. Butel of Baylor College of Medicine that indeed SV40 was present in a number of human tumors. The Telegraph article went on to automatically equate the SV40 with the polio vaccines pre-1963. Dr. Janet Butel has now said that that particular article went too far. I do not think, however, that the London Telegraph article should be dismissed. Indeed, Ed Haslam's vitally important and landmark book, Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus, connects research into the cancer-causing SV40 virus, which contaminated the polio vaccine, with an apparent research project to create a benign strain of that virus to inoculate Americans against what has now developed into a soft tissue cancer epidemic. In turn, the research into that potential vaccine mutation was connected very convincingly by Ed Haslam to the milieu of the assassination of President Kennedy, and in addition to reporting the unreported soft tissue cancer epidemic now sweeping the United States, Ed goes on to speculate about the possibility that when that genetic research fell into the wrong hands, it may have led to the creation of AIDS, which appears to have stemmed from genetically altered monkey viruses. Again, there are numerous programs available from Spitfire, including RFA-16, and numerous interviews with Ed Haslam, the aforementioned Drs. Cantwell and Horowitz, and also Garth Nicholson that touch on those and related subjects. Of the paper that led to the London Telegraph article about the possible connection between SV40 and the polio vaccine and cancer, we find the following. This is from the San Francisco Examiner of Friday, February 19th of 1999. It's Dateline Washington, headlined, Simian Virus Cancer Link Not Proved, Doctor Says. It's an AP story, Dateline Washington, and it reads in part, an American scientist says a London newspaper misinterpreted her study of a monkey virus and early polio vaccines when the paper said the virus had been proved cancer-causing, unquote, and could be responsible for hundreds of cancer deaths. It's one step farther than I'm prepared to go, unquote, Dr. Janet S. Butel, B-U-T-E-L, of Baylor College of Medicine, said of the report in the London Sunday Telegraph. Skipping down, the Telegraph article said the monkey virus that contaminated pre-1963 polio vaccinations was cancer-causing, unquote, and might be responsible for hundreds of deaths. The newspaper based its report on Butel's study published last month in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. Quote, there is no evidence that the virus found in some human tumors came from the polio vaccine, unquote, she said. The monkey virus has been found in the tumors of people who were not even alive at the time the contaminated polio vaccine was used, she said. Well, that is not conclusive in that the virus can be passed through sexual contact. It is present in semen. It can also be passed from mothers to children, the evidence suggests. So the fact that people who were not even alive at the time the contaminated polio vaccine was used are getting cancer, and that the SV40 is found in those tumors, does not prove that it did not come from the polio vaccine. Again, it is sexually transmitted, among other things. And some more on that. In her study, Butel reviewed evidence from her research and from others' research about the spread and disease potential of simian virus 40, or SV40, found to have contaminated a polio vaccine introduced in 1955. The contamination was only in vaccines used before 1963. Butel said in the paper that, quote, the association of SV40 with human cancers is currently strong enough to warrant serious concern, unquote. And to indicate how much stronger that concern should be than what is indicated in this article, Ed Haslam's book, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, the numerous interviews and half-hour segments dealing with Ed Haslam's work will provide a good jumping-off point. Right next to that article, again from the San Francisco Examiner of Friday, February 19th of 1999, is another very important story, also an AP story, also Dateline Washington. This headlined, Farmers and Environmentalists Sue Over Genetically Altered Seeds. And this alludes to not only genetically altered products that are being introduced into the agricultural market, but specifically the Terminator seeds that I've discussed at considerable length on my three-hour program that originates in the Bay Area. I have not discussed Terminator seeds in the half-hour segment syndicated to other stations. This article reads, again, from the Examiner 2, 1999, and right next to the article about the simian cancer virus. A coalition of environmentalists and organic farmers has filed a lawsuit against the Environmental Protection Agency to force the agency to ban the use of genetically altered seed in corn, cotton, and potatoes. The lawsuit was filed Thursday in U.S. District Court by Greenpeace International, the Center for Food Safety, and the International Federation of Organic Agricultural Movements. Quote, these crops are an environmental disaster waiting to happen, unquote, said Kaylee Kreider, K-R-E-I-D-E-R, a Greenpeace spokeswoman. Indeed, I second Ms. Kreider's assessment of the danger of these articles. Fortunately, articles are now beginning to filter into the mainstream press about the dangers of Terminator seeds. The first article that I have seen in the American mainstream press, I've seen it in the European mainstream press, was carried in an op-ed column that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, March 1st of 1999. This is an article authored by Anuradha Mittal, M-I-T-T-A-L, and Peter Rosset, R-O-S-S-E-T, who are the policy director and executive director, respectively, for Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy in Oakland. Their website, www.foodfirst.org. This article reads, Farmer Percy Schmeiser, S-C-H-M-E-I-S-E-R of Saskatchewan, was surprised when he was served with a lawsuit for, quote, doing what I've always done, unquote. Indeed, for what farmers have done for millennia, saving seeds for the next planting. Schmeiser is one of hundreds of Canadian and American farmers being sued by the biotech giant Monsanto Corporation for allegedly reusing proprietary genetically engineered seeds. Monsanto has a patent on those seeds and has forbidden farmers to save the seeds so that they will have to return to the company and buy new seed each year. But such questionable tactics as patenting life forms and charging for their use will soon be unnecessary if Monsanto has its way. The Terminator technology has arrived to make the gene police, unquote, redundant. Today, more than 30% of the corn and soybeans planted in the United States and close to 50% of the canola planted in Canada is genetically engineered. Biotech companies like Monsanto are aggressively protecting their patented seeds, asserting that it takes millions of dollars and years of research to develop such seeds. Monsanto has used legal means to protect its investment. But in the future, corporate profit protection will be biologically built into the plants. The technology protection system, dubbed the Terminator technology by critics, was developed by scientists at the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Delta Pine Land Company, a Mississippi seed company being purchased by Monsanto. The technology creates crop plants that kill their own offspring by producing sterile seeds. The aim is to help biotechnology companies retain control over their patented crops by making it impossible for farmers to save the seeds for replanting. Saving and exchanging seeds with neighbors has always been an integral part of the social fabric of rural communities worldwide, including here in America. The for-profit intrusion of global corporations has the potential to rend that social fabric and turn neighbors, once joined together by the need to survive, into competitors. In addition to the social implications, this latest assault on nature has serious economic and environmental implications. International farm and environmental organizations have raised the alarm. Seed saving is an age-old tradition throughout the world, and this new technology could potentially threaten in the developing world more than 1 billion subsistence farmers who depend upon saved seed for their food security. Beyond creating a dependence on cash to buy these genetically engineered seeds each year, the technology threatens farmers' expertise in seed selection and traditional plant breeding. There is no guarantee that the Terminator, unquote, will remain in the intended crop varieties. Pollen from Terminator plants can fertilize nearby native plants, making them sterile. Wild relatives of crop varieties, important for natural evolution of crop species, once affected by cross-contamination, could endanger the world's food supply. It could even lead to the extinction of traditional varieties. This, quote, genetic pollution, unquote, can be much harder to fight than old-style pollution. Unlike an oil spill, you can't just throw a boom around it. There is another concern that relates to so-called intellectual property rights, unquote. Patenting genes the same way you patent software robs third-world farmers. While they and their ancestors develop almost all important food crops, transnational corporations can now blithely patent those crops and make mega profits without in any way compensating traditional farm communities for the original research. Genetic resources taken freely from southern countries will be returned to them later as pricey patented commodities. Terminator technology is a way of locking this biopiracy into the very genes themselves. And again, the Food First Institute for Food and Development Policy's website, www.foodfirst.org. That op-ed column again from the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, March 1st of 1999. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.